we have to kind of actively push them out. And that's the only way, because otherwise it's going to be Donbas once again, mm-hmm. with this kind of demarcation line, and then them bombing us, mm-hmm. us shooting back. But then you have Ukrainians who follow the treaties, like mm-hmm. ceasefire and all this stuff, and you have Russians who kind of shoot themselves to provoke and all that. So it's a very nasty neighbor we have.
Yeah, we know, and
it's not like you can move out. It's not like you have a neighbor upstairs that you can just sell the apartment, move out, and get another place.
Nasty neighbor. As a Polish citizen, I can relate. Taras is Ukrainian, living in Lviv with his wife, kids, and now his work colleague and her family as well. They moved to Taras's from Kiev the very first days of the Russian aggression. Taras's place is full, but that's nothing new in Lviv. Almost everybody hosts somebody from the eastern part of the country. According to the mayor, the city hosts an extra 300,000 people right now. Taras and his friend Kristina will be our guides of Lviv's critical aid and support points. It's day 21 of the Russian invasion.
It has been, you know, a fairly relatively safe place. Uh-huh. I think we had a couple explosions in day one.
Day one?
In day one, February 24.
Okay. Where would they come from? Like, who?
So, those are like military targets around, or infrastructure targets around the region. Uh-huh. Since the time, I think it was reasonably quiet. Sirens aside, of course. And then I think 2 or 3 days ago there was a big bombing at Yavoriv peacekeeping center. That's when I expected, you know, people to probably start to feel a little bit more unsafe. But we don't feel that yet. So Lviv kind of remains a fairly, well, reasonably quiet, peaceful place. You do feel it's war by a number of things. First of all, you have a huge traffic of people, you know, coming inbound and outbound as they depart to Poland. So lots of cars, lots of people, obviously. Then you have this huge humanitarian crisis within the city because the infrastructure is pressured. I mean, it's on the edge, pretty much. I think everyone I know probably hosts somebody. So yeah, you have this kind of humanitarian issue, and you also sense it from shortages in supplies. So when you go to the shopping mall, you see one of two pictures. Either shelves are empty, or they are piled, but they are piled with the same stuff, right?
Really?
So instead of like having different cookies, different like, or
types,
I don't know,
of
whatever
cookies.
Else, yeah, like food or something else. You would see kind of the same stuff occupying, you know, a huge volume of space, because they cannot, I mean, there's not no longer that diversity of supplies.
As we walk towards Lviv railway station to meet Kristina, we pass by hundreds of people with suitcases, backpacks, or sometimes just plastic bags filled with things they managed to grab while fleeing their homes. Most will take the free evacuation trains to Przemysl on Polish side. Others queue for buses. Unlike on the train station, queues for buses move fast, but one has to pay for the ticket. The price varies, and the drivers take only cash, which now can be problematic.
Yeah. Well, it varies by bank. For example, the one I'm using, it has 10,000 hryvnia withdrawal limit per card per day. And it could also give you 1,000 hryvnia in case you're using card of a different bank. We were working to arrange the transportation of our folks abroad, and they said cash only, and it was like 50 grand. And we were like, okay, how do you expect us to get that?
50,000
hryvnia. Yeah, which is, I mean, it's not that big money, but then if you want a cash only, then that's a bigger deal.
How would the transportation happen? Is it by car or?
We did buses.
And buses are that expensive?
Well, it depends on the destination point. And also depends on on the person. Because also with the living space, you have some people who kind of keep the prices at the same level, and you have some who kind of spike the bump like 2-3 times.
We finally meet Krystyna, and together we reach the railway station. A small aid city grew in front of this beautiful railway building. Most help is organized by individual Ukrainians who, just like Krystyna and Taras, simply couldn't imagine not being engaged. I can also spot some logos of the Polish Red Cross and some American organizations. Most give out food, some freshly cooked, some dry, for the road. There is a medical point and a stand with clothes.
Here, everybody help people. It's and the organization and just people and from other country people who just want to help us.
What are you doing specifically?
Specifically, I'm buying pills for our soldiers. I buy clothes, warm clothes, because 1 week ago it was really cold.
Yes.
And Hargil, it was 20 degrees.
Yes.
Also, I also help other people from Kyiv. Help 10 people with home. Me and my mother, my family in Ukraine.
Mm-hmm.
You are safe. I'm really happy. I also hope that other people also will be able to save another country.
Are you working as an organization or individual?
Individual.
Mm-hmm.
I work individual. I understood I need to help my country.
Komendantski czas starts at 10 p.m.
Yes.
So nobody can be outside.
Yes, but these people can be because they don't have nothing. Yes, mm-hmm. They have just their documents, and if they are not from Kyiv or Lviv or Lviv, they can be here. Also, if you don't have documents, you're a volunteer.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. You can't help.
Okay, you have to have official documents that you're a volunteer
here. Yes, yes.
Okay.
Komendantski czas is a curfew hour. Every day from 10 p.m. to 6 a.m., nobody is allowed to be outside. Police and army check everybody's documents and background. However, hundreds of people who came from the east and have no other place to sleep are allowed to stay at the railway station. The train schedule is tentative, and there are some cancellations every day. Other trains come late, some much earlier. One has to simply wait in lines. Before the war, train from Lviv to Przemyśl would take only 2.5 hours. Last week, most trains would take 20. This week, however, the situation improves.
They have problems with people transportation previous week,
mm-hmm.
but this week is easier. So this way will go on for 3-4 hours.
Oh,
3-4 hours. Yes.
That's fine.
Yes.
So we just wait in the line and then 3-4
yes.
hours on the
yes.
train.
Yes. Yes. But they don't know really when this train will come in.
Mm-hmm.
In less than a week, we will take one of those trains together with Ukrainians seeking asylum in Poland. The train will take less than 4 hours, plus about 2 for documents checking. We leave the station with Krystyna and Taras and take a tram to the city center. Taras buys tickets for all of us. He admits nobody checks the tickets and nobody would get a fine for not having one, but for him, it's a way to support his country's economy. Small, but important patriotic gesture. Since the beginning of the aggression, 52% of Ukrainians have lost their jobs. Krystyna and Taras work for a big international corporation, which allows them for a flexible work schedule so they can volunteer and organize aid.
Mother, and she's in Ukraine. She also helps other people
mm-hmm.
With home, mm-hmm. with food. Also, we are cooking on the risky cocktail, if you know.
Yes.
Awesome.
Yes, because we don't know if Putin want to kill us also. Mm-hmm. We need to prepare how we can.
Where are you doing this? Do you have like some like factories, warehouses?
We just find a lot of bottles, mm-hmm. and these bottles we give to the volunteers, and they
Good.
That's the only effective mean of resistance if you don't have you don't have guns.
Yeah, I can't imagine.
I mean, you cannot hit it with. I mean, you can hit it with sticks, but probably it would not be very effective.
This is true.
So, in the absence of guns, that's the only mean.
Yeah.
But you know, the country is very familiar with that weapon since 2014. Mm-hmm. You know.
Yes. You know, Ukrainian not tell us. Don't ask me how my family. My family is now 44 million.
Don't ask me how my family is. My family is 44 million right now. This sentence will stay with me. Out of those 44 million, by the day we edit this podcast, on March 30th, 4 million will already flee the country. Most residents of Lviv, however, declare they stay. Some for now, others can't imagine leaving, even if the front line moves towards the city. Even though restaurants, shops, and other businesses are open and the city seems to function as always, we have been reminded of the potential threat the very first evening in Lviv. We entered a restaurant for dinner. A nice waitress showed us to our table. A good one, as she put it. Close to the wall and far from the window.
You can't find alcohol in any store. Because now we have war and people need to have clear mind. So this is why we have this.
In the old town, monuments secured with sandbags and wooden beams attract attention. Windows of old churches are blocked with metal panels, and priceless paintings have been moved to basements. We take a break in one of many cafes in the old town, where Taras shares his thoughts on the situation.
Not many people give a damn, I mean, because even though it's Europe, even though it's so big, but it just has a different perception. Remember, like, you had those attacks in Paris? And the whole world was like, oh, I mean, we're so compassionate. And then you have Syria and like nobody gives a damn. And Ukraine is somewhere in the middle, I'd say. Mm-hmm. I mean, you guys sense it much more because you're so much closer. And now it there's a risk of it becoming much larger scale.
Yeah.
So people don't actually ignore it. But 2014, how much have you heard about 2014? Yeah, and I'm also, you know, a little bit surprised by world not taking a stance at this, because you have China sitting and watching, and if you allow the power of strong, then where would this world end? How many countries we're gonna have in the end? 5? I don't know. I mean I really cannot grasp why they wouldn't intervene. Of course, I'm not a politician, I'm not a military guy, but I have no idea why they wouldn't intervene, because what they are afraid of, that he's gonna send the nukes. I mean, he can do it anyway. If he realizes he's doomed, his last sentence could be just, you know, doing that. We're gonna get to him, but we're gonna get in a little while after many, many lives are lost. I think the outcome of this war, it's known. We're gonna win, because even if somebody had some doubts in the first days, I don't think anybody has any doubts now. What I'm afraid of that it's gonna stabilize like this. Like the front line is just simply gonna stall and fixate at what it is now, and then they will have opportunity to bombard Ukraine, like whichever spot of the country that they want, and we are not gonna be able to do anything. That's what I'm afraid of, because I think if we have to kind of actively push them out, and that's the only way, because otherwise it's gonna be Donbass once again, with this kind of demarcation line, and then them bombing us. Us shooting back, but then you have Ukrainians who follow the treaties, like ceasefire and all that stuff, and you have Russians who are gonna shoot themselves to provoke and all that. So It's a very nasty neighbor we have.
Yeah.
And it's not like you can move out. It's not like you have a neighbor upstairs that you can just sell the apartment, move out, and get another place, right? It's very hard to separate, and they are so nasty.
We shift from politics to everyday life. I'm interested in daily activities, work, family life. How can one organize themselves in this new reality?
We talk every day, we meet every day in the morning, and then you can tell by people's face expressions what happened on the news recently. You can very easily tell that. So if it's quiet, if it's peaceful, no bombings, no shootings, everyone's, happy and eager to work, and they're optimistic. And then you have this Yavoriv happening, and like everyone's just simply devastated because you have, first of all, you realize that bombings are like, 30 kilometers away from you, first of all. Second of all, you realize that it flew over your head, right? Because we are, Yavoriv is northwest of the city. So assuming the missiles were launched over Black Sea, it flew over us, right?
You're not thinking
so
about
this,
right?
This is not very, positive news. And then obviously you also have some people who were affected. You have so many people dead, wounded. You immediately have it over chat, like, hey, they need this stuff in the hospital. If you could collect like this kind of medicine or this whatever, So immediately there's a huge spike in emotions. And of course it affects everything that you do. Because otherwise Lviv is just, blessed to be geographically located so far from the active action. Mm-hmm. You don't, as I keep saying, you don't really feel it that much because it's somewhere, so distant, so remote.
How are you able to work efficiently in this situation?
Yeah, I'm not sure if we are that efficient at this point. No, it was tough. The first couple of days, of course, it was just falling apart. We were focusing on safety of staff, trying to get a hold of who's where, who's affected, if anyone's missing in there, if anyone was harmed. So that was, of course, priority one. Then we launched these evacuations right away abroad. Lots of our people, I think 170 of our staff are currently abroad. That's about almost 25%. So still not 100, but still, pretty significant amount. And we still do have a couple guys in Kyiv, but they don't want to leave. At this point, they're just, enormous spike of patriotism, and they're just like, no, we're staying. We're gonna take it all the way to the end.
Are they able to work at all? Are they fighting? Are they preparing?
Some, we have a couple guys in military, a couple of guys in territory defense. Many are volunteering, some are working. So, it's all about like your psychological state. What are you up to? I think what people are currently struggling with the most is like that sense of guilt, mm-hmm. that somebody's dying, somebody's literally giving their life away to defend the country. And then you're just sitting on your butt and, just clicking stuff in Excel. But at the same time, of course, like if you talk about finance, it's important, but it's not critical. But if you talk about, like, for example, food or medicine or whatever else, if this doesn't happen, it's just doomed, right? So even though people might feel, psychologically not in an actual state of work, but they have to work because that's the best they can do. Army doesn't need, 2 million people. Volunteers do not need 2 million people. So the best we can do, unless you're very good at fighting or very good at volunteering or anything else, the best you could do is just do your job, keep the money flowing, because like each revenue you earn, it lands either with the state budget or with taxes or with savings or with, purchases that you make. So you support the economy. And yeah, I guess that's the primary contribution you can make, because many people have lost their jobs, and obviously for them the choice would be to probably go volunteering and supporting it. But those who kept the jobs, I think especially with IT and especially all those kind of export oriented industries, you keep the currency flowing into the country, and I think that's one of the best things you could do these days.
we continue the tour. Next stop, Potocki Palace, a beautiful building constructed in 1880 as a seat of the former minister-president of Austria, later turned into a national art gallery. Today, it serves as a humanitarian aid point.
All people who need medicine, clothes, and other things, they can get it here after registration.
Mm-hmm.
Yes. So, as you can see, this line, he's too long.
Are people also staying here for the night if they need to sleep?
No. They don't here stay here at night. They just want to take something what they need. So. And if you see, here is number of people who can help, some lists, yes, some numbers. It's everything help people to find house and food and medicine.
And I assume those are people from east of the country,
yes,
right?
Yes.
So is this the main center for coordination?
Yes. This is the main center. Also, here is a lot of suppliers who can help us with medicine. So all people who want to help also go to this office.
The line to get aid is long. People have to register first, then wait for their turn to enter. The main volunteer at the door reads the names of those who are allowed in.
He's reading the names of people who can enter right now.
Yes.
Okay. So they
he has before. He has list and he reading these names and name which he reads goes to the.
Пані та панове, тут у центрі Львова, де кожна вулиця, кожен будинок це пам'ятка ЮНЕСКО, спадщина ЮНЕСКО. Вільне небо, free sky. Ми просимо і долучаємося до заклику президента України, українського народу, закрити небо над Україною. Ми обов'язково переможемо. Переможемо разом. Слава Україні!
There are two classical music concerts in the city today. Both in support of closing the sky. Everybody here highlights the importance of this action. To make it real for us, Christina shows us one of the city shelters. It's a basement, dark, cold, and moist.
I have windows. When people hear alarms, they go.
There's no light. There's nothing here, basically, right?
Yeah.
Oh.
As you see, it's a difficult situation, so you can stay here during a long time, as you see.
Mm-hmm.
In Melitopol and Izum, Mykolaiv, a lot of people live in such shelters, and they didn't have water, food, other things for life. It's
and
just awful.
Yeah. And it's very cold in here.
Yes, and you know, even some children are born in these shelters, and they have a lot of illnesses, a lot of problems. So I try, I hope these people will be able to get to Western Ukraine, because here is unsafe. Yes, but Putin.
Staying in this shelter for only a few minutes was a powerful experience. But we were about to undergo another one. After a few days in Lviv, we got used to the air raid alerts. The ones located in the city have limited range. That's why the government encouraged everybody to install a special app. It would usually go off 2 or 3 times a night. You hear it? You should look for a shelter. However, nothing hit Lviv yet, so after a while, many started ignoring the sirens. And then, on March 18th, instead of the air raid alert, we were awakened by an explosion. One, then the second. By the time the third one hit the ground, we were already halfway to the basement.
6:30 and we are actually in the basement of the house of our wonderful Lubomir and our host. We've been woken up just like 15 minutes ago with 2, maybe 3 bombs just falling very close to us here in Lviv, something that we did not expect. We really thought that it's not gonna happen here. We're in the basement. Actually, Lubomir has a small gym here. We just ran how our attack is organizing everything, of course. We're not sure exactly what happened, but apparently it's the airport that has been targeted. So we're waiting for now in the gym. It's an alert and we're just waiting for further instructions.
Russian attacked the international airport in Lviv that day, only 4 kilometers from the place we were staying in. Still, most residents of Lviv refused to leave, including Kristina, her mom, and Taras's wife. Thanks for listening to this special episode of Fractured, produced by Sonia Nanjik-Herman and Douglas Herman, in cooperation with Refocus Media Labs and Mixed Migration Abdo. Music, as always, by Eamon Kelly. If you want to know more about the refugee crisis and migration, we encourage you to follow Refocus Media Labs on social media and sign up for Joel Hernandez's Mixed Migration Abdo newsletter. And if you're interested in supporting our humanitarian aid for Ukraine and Ukrainians in Poland, please visit refocusmedialabs.org/Ukraine-support.